Spirit Radio Podcasts.
And joined with me on the line now, I have Therese Davey for this week's Home and Lifestyle Tips. Good morning to you, Therese. How are you?
Fine, thank you, Wendy. Back to work today after a lovely long Easter break.
Lovely, probably. We'll go easy on you, seeing as you're just getting back into things. But one of the things that today is Lyme Awareness Day. Okay, I don't know a lot about Lyme disease, so you'll have to tell me about it.
And May is Lyme Disease Awareness Month, and you and I have touched on this for the past 3 years since my neighbour developed the disease and found it very hard to get it identified and had to go away to get treatment abroad for it because it wasn't as well known as it is nowadays in Ireland. Lyme disease is the fastest growing vector-borne infection spread by ticks in the world at the moment. And you can get it, the weather is warming up and the ticks are out there and there's a greater population of deer, which people tend to blame in Ireland for the increase in it in Lyme disease in Ireland. And so the woods and the grasslands where the grass is growing taller, sitting on the edge of the long grass, there are some ticks ready to hop onto you and your children or your dogs because they need to move on, and that's how they do it. They're sitting on the edge of the grass.
So how do you avoid them? Is it covering up?
That's just, yes, absolutely. And so my website of the week is ticktalkireland.org. The HSE website also has a good section on it, but ticktalkireland.org are the people who have the disease and who are talking to each other and give you all kinds of information about prevention and awareness and what it actually is and how to identify it. They call it a bullseye virus, kind of a little prick in the middle and the kind of spots on the outside graduating. That's the first thing you see is a rash. And you can easily recover from the rash. You get an antibiotic and that's solvable if you can identify it and solve it and go to your doctor at that stage as quick as it happens. But some of the most basic things are covering your legs, not wearing the shorts going through the grasslands and the wood. They go for arms and legs primarily first. That's the first place they'll get there. Getting used to checking at the car when you get back or when you get home, checking your children's legs, checking your own arms and legs.
So what are you looking for? What does a tick look like?
A tick is like a very, very small little insect, and the more it eats, the more it gorges on your blood, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it becomes the size, it can become the size of a small pea. It can get that big, but you, normally when they're hopping onto you, they're not as big as that. And you need to be careful removing them because sometimes you can leave part of them behind and that can cause the infection. So there's a specific way to get rid of them and remove ticks from you with the tweezers and how to do it properly and what to look for. And all that information is on both the websites, TikTok Ireland and the HSE website, telling you how to remove the tick, how to pick it out properly and how to treat it afterwards and what to look for so it doesn't graduate to the terrible, terrible illnesses that it can. Now, the extreme illnesses that you can get are the minority of people who are infected, but it is a terrible thing to happen to someone, and you can prevent it by covering your legs and arms when you're going out in the grasslands or walking, and if you're going hill climbing and bogs and things where there will be tall grass and where they can hop onto you. And just being aware of when you get back to the car or when you get home, doing a quick check on the backs of legs and the backs of necks and children as well and arms to see that they're not there. But all that information is there on TikTokIreland.org and the HSE website if you put in Lyme disease. Important to talk about it, important to identify it. It is the fastest growing thing. And when you start talking to Wendy, you'd be surprised how many people have had it or have had ticks. And my neighbour can actually remember when she got bitten. She can quite clearly, she was out on a picnic and she can remember getting bitten, but never associated until months later and had been quite sick with it. But if we all know about it and we all know what to do, we can prevent it.
And especially when, as you say, you need to know the exact right way to remove a tick because it can do a lot of harm if you don't do it the right way. All right, Therese, what is out there then this week?
Well, Lidl's gone summer mad altogether, and there's some lovely four-wheel drive bags, and I say it every year, once you try a four-wheel holiday bag, you'll never go back to two wheels again, and they have an offer on those. But they have a very clever foldable backpack for $4.99, and I really like that one. It folds into a pack in itself, but it is a proper backpack with straps and things, $4.99. And the other thing that I always say when they have them is they have a great six-pack extension lead for $4.99 with a light on and off switch, a black one, a dark one, which is quite useful, rather than having the double adapters, which are dangerous. There's a folding furniture set with adjustable legs, and this is why I'm saying about this. You can move it up and down for the children, and four stools for camping or picnics. That was good. Completely folds into itself. The stools and everything fold into kind of like a case, and something I have never seen before, a folding barbecue.
I've definitely never seen that either. What will they think of next?
I know, what will they think of next? And it's really clever. $16.99. Folds flat up, put on the side of the wall of the garage and take it out when you want it. But also, there's another chance to buy some of those tomato plants, and I potted on mine with my five-year-old grandniece. It's our annual job. We do it together. I potted on my tomato plants that have been growing for 2 weeks in the hall window, and now they went out to the glasshouse. 89 cents each a plant, and the strawberries are also 89 cents. This is the year to grow them. And please ask your neighbour for the peanut buckets. You know the clear peanut buckets that you can get at the kilo or a couple of kilos of peanuts? They're perfect for growing your strawberries when they're empty. Or ask your local food shop for the mayo bucket, a deli counter. My local Spar Mullins in the Bundoran Road leave their buckets outside. This is in Sligo. They leave them outside the shop. They just stack them up outside and people take them as they want them. They never have to dump them, never have to recycle them, because people just take them and use them for all kinds of things. So check your local deli, because they're dead handy to have.
Okay, so now, you've got a very interesting list for us this week, Trace.
I couldn't resist this one because I was looking up on my normal American website. It's a very interesting woman who has loads of tips and hints and things. And she said, 7 things you should never vacuum up. Things you shouldn't feed your vacuum. And I thought, oh, I like that one. And maybe they need to be said. And one of them was glass. Resist the temptation to grab your vacuum when the glass gets broken, because glass can damage your vacuum internally. It can tear the bags. It can cause an awful mess further down. And also, it's dangerous, Wendy. Bits of glass are dangerous to have floating around on the edges of vacuum cleaners and bags. And even if you have a cylinder one and you don't have a bag, if it's bagless, it's not something you should have. And it's not something you should get lodged in the hose either, because you might put your finger in to clean something else out and cut your finger with a piece of glass. And if you've ever had an embedded piece of glass, it's something you do not want, and you forget about it. But she had a really clever way of gathering up the glass instead, a damp paper towel or a piece of bread. This was really clever, and I watched the video, a slice of sliced pan, and she rubbed it all over the ground to pick up the loose pieces of glass. Really, really simple. And she had 7 other uses for bread, and I'm going, that's next week's tips. Absolutely, I'll find them for next week. The other thing was water. Don't ever attempt, even if it's only a small amount. If moisture gets trapped in your vacuum, it can cause mildew growth. Forget about damaging the electrics, and water and electricity do not mix, but causing mildew, just think about it and the smell. No, you don't want that. Makeup. Here was an interesting one, and she's given the reasons why you should never vacuum up bits of powder or makeup that fall, because it'll get caught in your brush, and you could smear the makeup later on further on carpet.
You're
or
makeuping
something else.
Your carpet then instead of your face.
Yes, absolutely. Foundation on the wool. Yeah, not good. So that was interesting. Long hair. And she said maybe if you're cutting hair, there's some kind of long hair cutting going on in the kitchen or something, don't vacuum it up at all. It gets knotted up in the brushes and it prevents them from working properly, and it can clog other parts of the machine and you don't need it. Brush it up. Get out the dustpan and brush. Don't be tempted to go and get it. And particularly people now have all kinds of handheld vacuums and things that can hang up, and they're using them for everything. And I know what she's thinking about it. It's just become easier to vacuum things. But coins was the other thing, or anything small and heavy can be very hard on a vacuum's motor, and they can damage small parts inside your vacuum that you don't see, apart from ripping through the bags. So we'll get the brush for that one as well. And the other thing to be careful about was cords, loose cords. So that's happened. Has that ever happened to you? And did you ever suck up a cord in your own vacuum? And it damages them. It can be dangerous. It's to the cords themselves, because you mightn't see the tear that you've caused with that suction, but it's dangerous for the vacuum as well. But she also said it's very important to clean and empty the bags regularly. Just make a habit of emptying the bag or your dust cart or cup when you're finished, because they become less effective if there's more dust, and that's logical, and it avoids overheating. And please go and look at your manual for your vacuum and see how do they suggest
there's
to
a
clean
manual
your filter. Yeah. Now, do I have to say this again? you need your manual file. Everyone needs a folder for all your manuals.
And you know what, Ray, there isn't even
handy.
An excuse, because for most things now, if you do lose it and you go online, there's a PDF of the manual that you can download. I do know that. Reading it is the next part.
And that's a whole other thing, and another file on your computer for all the PDF manuals. But just to see how do they expect you, or how do they want you to clean the filters and the HEPA filters or the dust filters. They're not going to work properly if they're clogged up with dirt and dust. It makes sense that you need to keep those things clean and clear so the maximum amount of air gets through and you make your appliance work better. So keep the appliance manuals in one folder and somewhere you can remember and access handy enough if you can't be bothered to go and download the PDFs. But that's the vacuum, that's what we're talking about. So today is Vacuum Care Day. It's Lyme Disease Day, Lyme Awareness Day, but it's also Clean Your Vacuum Day.
And buy a fold-up barbecue for hopefully a good bank holiday weekend.
$16.99, yeah, fold-up barbecue, and one of those fold-up rucksacks. But also, what I wanted to tell you about was where I was over Easter.
Oh, you're okay. Always in interesting places, go on.
I was in the European Parliament in Strasbourg.
And tell us about that experience, Therese. What was it like?
This is election. This election fever has hit the country and we see the posters everywhere. They're all over the place. But I had the privilege of going to the Parliament and seeing a proper debate and a proper vote, because for many years I canvassed for an MEP who was retiring. But I didn't agree with some of the treaties, all of the treaties, but I do believe in the European Union. I do believe it works. We have a peaceful Europe and things can happen, and your MEP can make a difference. They can make a difference even for you at a local level. So please go out and vote and hear what they have to say and listen, and don't be afraid to challenge them. It does relate to you. Just because Strasbourg was miles away and Brussels seems very far away, it does relate to you. And the MEP I worked in, two people asked her to do something about the cyclists who were getting knocked down by all the big lorries in Ireland. There seemingly 26 people a year were getting killed with that, and so she investigated legislation and got it through, and the mirrors went on the big lorries and saved 300 lives a year across Europe. So your MEP can make a difference, and not many politicians can say they save 300 lives a year, but the one I canvassed for did and does. And so please get out and vote and talk to them and challenge them, because it does work. The European Parliament can work. It has many daft things and many imposing things, and I don't like big government either, but I do believe in it as a principle. And please vote for your European
Indeed.
MEP. Don't let it go.
And educate yourself on the local representatives running in your area to see who would actually get your vote as well. You've got to read up on these things and chat to them as well. Therese, as always, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Therese Davey with this week's Home and Lifestyle Tips. Well, later on in the programme, we're going to be getting an update from John Pontifex from Aid to the Church in Need on the recent terrorist attacks in churches in Sri Lanka. Now, I suppose this in one way has put Christian persecution back on the agenda, but for us here at Spirit Radio, where we regularly cover Christian persecution in countries throughout the world, we're always frustrated to see that it's very, very rarely covered elsewhere. And there was an opinion piece in last week's New York Times which asked the question, are Christians privileged or persecuted? And in the piece, the journalist wrote that the main victims of Western liberalism's peculiar relationship to its Christian heritage aren't put upon traditionalists in the West. They're Christians like the murdered first communicants in Sri Lanka, or the jailed pastors in China, or the Coptic martyrs of North Africa, or any of the millions of non-Western Christians who live under constant threat of persecution. So when you think of that quote, I think a lot of people might know what happened in Sri Lanka, but a lot of the other things that were mentioned there, a lot of people wouldn't be aware of it all, because it's not covered, it's not talked about. But why is there this particular phenomenon? Or is it? Are we imagining it? The reluctance of Western people and Western media to talk about attacks on Christians in other parts of the world? Well, in studio to discuss why people don't seem to care about Christian persecution, we have columnist and blogger and recent graduate from Oxford University, Ben Conroy, with us in studio. Ben, good morning to you and thanks for coming back.
Thanks very much for having me on, Wendy.
Well, just in terms of the actual context for Christian persecution, how widespread is it?
Yeah, I think this is something that, as you said, people, a lot of people just don't quite realise. There's just a bit of lack of knowledge here. So according to Open Doors, a group that deals with and tries to raise awareness of and help persecuted Christians worldwide, there's 11 Christians every day are killed because of their faith, right? So this is in the top 50 most dangerous countries to be a Christian. So this is not indirect killings of Christians. It's Christians who are killed for being Christians. There's just an immense amount of persecution out there. Obviously, there's the completely tragic cases of Iraq and Syria, where in Iraq there was 1.5 million Christians in 2003. In 2018, estimates vary. It's hard to get a precise figure, but somewhere around maybe 250,000, so maybe a sixth of the Christian population are still there, having been killed or driven out. You know, attacks in Nigeria by herdsmen, Hindu nationalist mobs in India. There's a lot of Christian persecution in the world, and sometimes it's just, it's astounding. It's not more of a story.
And that's the thing, is that it doesn't seem to be focused on in the same way as other, you know, maybe minority religions, depending on the country. But there isn't really, I guess, an acceptance or even an analysis of the fact that it's happening. But it was even interesting to see here that, you know, when those dreadful attacks happened in New Zealand, our leaders were very, very quick to come out with statements and condolences, and rightly so. But when the attack happened in Sri Lanka, I think it was maybe 4 days before the Taoiseach made any sort of statement at all.
It's strange. It's definitely strange. Of course, it's absolutely right and proper that people respond to attacks against anyone who's persecuted with equal force and fervour. I think, and it's just when somebody is not, when a particular group of persecuted people don't get this, there seems to be something missing. I was lucky enough to attend a talk by the EU's envoy for religious freedom outside the EU recently, a man called Jan Figel, and he had a kind of a framework, because I was very interested in this question: why don't people talk about Christian persecution as much? What's the real answer, beyond just kind of complaining about it? Why is it really the case? And he had this three-part framework, which I thought was very good. He said it's a matter of ignorance, indifference, and fear.
Okay, so one, people don't know what's happening.
Yeah, just as we said earlier, it doesn't tend to get covered. Indifference is the standard thing that applies to a lot of things. There's a lot of bad things that go on in the world, and people don't care about a lot of them.
And we become immune to it or apathetic, basically.
Yeah, so yeah. Some of this stuff is the same problems that affect other cases of people suffering and people being persecuted across the world. The third one is interesting, though, and it's fear. And I think it's a fear, mostly, of being seen to be on kind of the wrong team. Because, you know, historically in Ireland, Christianity had a very privileged place, right? So, you know, if you go back for the last, you know, over the last hundred years, you know, Catholicism used to have a particular place in the Constitution. Still a lot of schools are Catholic. There's a sense that if you sort of talk about Christians being persecuted as Christians, it feels a bit uncomfortable.
That they deserve to be a protected group.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it ever rises to that level of kind of conscious enunciation, but I think it's there in the kind of subconscious. What else but to explain the fact that a Taoiseach could just let 4 days go by after this horrific attack without actually mentioning it? I think there's also something really interesting with that, and it's not so much a kind of a... The incipient thought isn't like, oh, Christians deserve what they get. Absolutely not. It's something more like this. Christianity is kind of our thing. Even if we've abandoned it, it's kind of ours to not care about. It's our, you know, in the same way as you can be mean about your friend, but you can't, you know, be mean about someone who's not your friend. There's sort of a sense that there's something a bit bad form about complaining about Christian persecution. It sort of seems like, in some way, drawing attention to ourselves. But I think that's completely wrong-headed, you know. And maybe Christians are privileged in Ireland in the past, and maybe in a lot of the West, Christians compared to other groups still have a lot of privilege and you know, safety from persecution compared to others. But this privilege is so context sensitive, Wendy. It's not, Christians in Nigeria, Christians in Iraq are not privileged. They're the least privileged people. And so when we take our sort of intuitions and good feelings about the way things are in the West and just sort of transfer them like this, it really does these people a terrible disservice.
And that's the thing, is the first point that Jan Figel made in terms of ignorance and not knowing that it's happening. That's a different thing, I suppose, to knowing that it's happening and not wanting to talk about it or report on it.
Yeah.
Which might happen to a certain extent. I mean, you mentioned Nigeria there. I think in a short space of time, 90,000 Christians alone have lost their lives, have been murdered, basically, as you say, not, you know, as a byproduct of civil unrest or war or something, but just for being Christian. Mm. That is the reason why. And I guess, you know, when you think of from the Western perspective,
yep.
Maybe we certainly here probably take for granted the freedom that we have to practice our religion. Perhaps it's a different type of, more of a kind of social persecution people might experience.
Yeah, I actually want to come in on that, because I think there's a challenge there, right? Because there is, as it, you know, there's definitely a case that in the West a lot of things that Christians care about are under attack, right? And so I think there's sometimes a temptation to start talking about persecution, using that word. And then there's another and I think that can be really bad, because when you're over-egging the pudding on your own problems, it can make the real, much more severe problems of people in these areas seem less serious. At the same time, you don't want to diminish the real challenges that Christianity faces in the West. A good way of thinking about it, I think, is to be, in the West, we should be more concerned with others. If Christian values are under attack, if things that matter to the Christian view of the common good are increasingly and being marginalized in the West, that's not so much bad for us Christians. It's bad for the people who aren't. It's bad for a society that's kind of going in a less good direction. But it's not, oh, we are the poor, put-upon Christians. You know, the primary victims here are us. So to distinguish between marginalization, which is definitely happening in the West, and persecution, which with a couple of rare exceptions isn't, I think is a good way to be real about what's going on without actually trying to make ourselves seem like the kind of victims that we're not, and diminishing the plight
when
of the real victims.
When you consider, you know, what true persecution actually is, just in terms of people actually losing their lives. But in a way, they're not entirely disconnected, because you could also argue, because Christians in the West are marginalised, that they don't have the confidence to talk about the persecution of Christians in other countries, because Christians are seen as fair game in terms of mocking them or, you know, dissing their faith. As you say, it's kind of seen as, well, not cool, I guess, from a media's perspective, to actually cover the issues then.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the lack of confidence thing is a real thing. I think the idea that in some ways we're standing up for that, the idea that it's bad form to stand up for some of the most vulnerable people in the world is a crazy idea, and it does come from that fear that Jan Figel talked about. And I think the fear can contribute to the ignorance, because if one group of people who are responsible for disseminating information are just a bit less likely to cover Christian persecution relative to other things. And again, to be clear, you want equal treatment. Christians shouldn't be saying, oh, we want the media to be more concerned about Christian persecution than they are about other kinds of persecution. Persecution of human beings is bad,
regardless of their faith.
Exactly. But it's just a matter of making sure that there is a fair and decent and an equal amount of attention paid, so that we can relieve the plight of Christians
and
as much as anybody else.
It's not about, oh, well, let's count the column inches. What it's about, can we actually do something?
Can we do
about
something?
It?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I guess, you know, when you think of the interventions, for example, at a state level from the government's perspective, often governments will intervene or, you know, try to be a voice when they look at cultures that are culturally closest. Now, because we have a Christian heritage, you think then it would make sense for our government to really stand up against Christian persecution.
Yeah, and I think there's this, and I think, again, it comes from not necessarily a bad place to say, okay, we don't want to give our own culture special treatment. We don't want to kind of, you know, there's a sort of a Christian idea in just ministering to non-Christians as much as you minister to Christians. That's something that comes from Christianity. It's a good impulse, but when it leads to the diminishment of the suffering of Christians, it's a mistake. In terms of what people can actually do, I think you were so right to draw attention to, you know, what should people actually do. There are great groups. John Pontifex from Age to Church in Need is going to be on next. Open Doors is another really good group for Christian persecution worldwide. Another thing people can do, I think, is talk to their politicians. Because, again, a lot of politicians are quite ignorant about this, too. To give credit where credit is due, the Asia Bibi case, the woman who's being persecuted for blasphemy in Pakistan, Brendan Howlin actually gave a very full-throated defence of her and said, is there anything the Irish government can do for her and Dáil? And I wouldn't be surprised if that was a matter of somebody going and talking to him and actually getting him informed. And one thing you can do is you can go into your constituency committee and say, look at this issue, look at Nigeria, look at Iraq, look at India, and indeed look at Sri Lanka. Can you raise this in the Dáil? Can you give this a bit more of a platform? It's something that a lot of TDs might be a bit more open to than they are on other issues. Because frankly, you know, when you actually hear the details, it's hard not to be moved. It's hard not to say this is something that really deserves attention. And one thing that people listening can do is they can say, I'm going to get informed on this. I'm going to go into my constituency office of my local TD and say, let's put a spotlight on this. And politics is so much more than voting. Like, there's so much action you can do in terms of getting involved with your public representatives and just yourself to raise awareness for this type of stuff.
And one of the things I often think is for us as individuals, and just in terms of our own faith, from an individual perspective is often when we're covering stories like Asia Bibi, as you mentioned, who was willing to basically lose her life for her faith. And that's the case in a lot of countries where people, they love their faith so much, they believe in God so deeply that they will lay their life down for it. And I think that's actually an incredible witness when we're thinking of our own faith, or we're talking to others about it, saying, look, there's you might mock what I believe, but you know, there's people in countries all over the world that believe this so fervently that they will put their life on the line for it. There's very few things that people believe in that much that they'll do that for.
No, it's incredible. It should be a challenge to us, right? Because as you say, sometimes there's a situation where you're like, oh yeah, by speaking about this, I could make life marginally more awkward for myself. And you know, not to even say marginally, you know, it could make it a lot more awkward for myself. There could be real consequences to talking about stuff. And then you think about the martyrs that are being made every day and the people who are just so utterly committed to what they believe that they are willing to die. I think it should be a bit of an indictment of us both for not paying enough attention to them and for not kind of being willing to do so much less than they are willing to do.
And as you say, feel that this might be an awkward conversation or whatever. Well, very interesting discussion today. I've been talking to Ben Conroy. You can check him out on Twitter, by the way, Ben JD Conroy, if you want to tweet him there, and keep an eye out for his blog and various articles in different places. You're popping up all over the place these days, Ben, and thanks for coming on Spirit Radio this morning.
Thanks so much.
In studio to tell us about an incredible trip that she had over Easter. I'm thinking of how I spent my Easter, lovely and all as it was, beautiful, blessed family time and all that sort of stuff. I have to say I was a little bit envious when following the photos of my next guest trip, because she has added to her list of incredible destinations as she's got to be, but not just the kind of touristy side of things, really getting into the nitty gritty of a new place and a new culture. In studio to tell us about her recent trip to Lebanon, we have our head of news, Áine Carr. Never a dull moment for you, Áine.
That's for sure, Wendy.
Why did you decide to go to Lebanon?
Well, I suppose to bring it back to sort of the whole basics of it all, this Easter was always going to be a very different Easter for me because, as probably not many people know, I lost both my mum and dad in the last 12 months. So it's been a difficult journey. And
so Easter for you usually would have been with your family.
With
your
my family,
yeah, of course.
Yeah. So I suppose I decided I wanted to have a geographical escape. Of course, you can never really escape mentally or emotionally, but geographically, I wanted to go somewhere new and have a new experience. And I actually, my first choice, believe it or not, was Syria, because I've reported so much on Syria. I have this bee in my bonnet that I want to actually, you know, see what I report on. But that wasn't going to work out within the time frame because it's quite a difficult place to get to. So in any case, if you did want to go to Syria, you have to go to Lebanon and cross over land. So that I thought, well, you know what, I'm going to book the flights to Lebanon and let's see. But then as it became clear that Syria was not going to work out, I thought, okay, let's Lebanon it is. And, you know, who knows what awaits there. So it was kind of by default, slightly, that I ended up there. And I was just so busy beforehand. All I did was book my flights and a hotel as a base. And I went into Easons before I left to ask if they had a guidebook. And one doesn't exist.
So basically, there isn't really a whatever they're called, Lonely Planet or...
No, apparently not. No, I mean, so I just turned up and let it unfold.
Well, when you think of that it's not, you wouldn't think when you think of a touristy destination, and certainly maybe a place for travelling by yourself as a young woman or whatever, you mightn't think of Lebanon. Were you nervous heading over there? You hadn't planned too much of an itinerary. You just were kind of seeing which way the wind blew.
No, I wasn't really nervous. I don't tend to go, in the past now, it has been a little while, but in the past I would have been used to, you know, backpacking around South America and Southeast Asia. So I'm kind of used to sort of solo travel. So I know I know I get a real kick out of it because of the people that you meet, and you're forced to be so much more open when you're on your own. So no, I wasn't nervous. I think family and friends were more nervous because, you know, I think because we have the association of, you know, with the Irish soldiers being in the UN and going to the Leb, that, you know, that's what we think of. And we kind of forget, well, actually that was like 30 years ago, but that's the residue that's left we have this idea that it's a kind of a dangerous place, you know, be careful, you know, don't do this, don't do that, don't take photographs of this, you know, don't go alone with a taxi driver, this type of thing. But anyway, I But you know, it was fabulous.
And you were there for Easter. What was that like?
Well, first of all, to get there was that was a very interesting experience, because I got, well, I actually, there's many ways to sort of actually arrive in the country. I chose Turkish Airlines. What really attracted me was because, I mean, there's, as I say, there's various different airlines. You can go through Lufthansa with Germany, you can go British Airways, but they just changed airport. They used to be I flew via Istanbul, which is the way, sort of an easy way to go there, because you're looking for the airline, really, when you have a limited amount of time, you don't want two or three layovers, so this was going to be my best option.
So it's about 4 hours to Istanbul, then what happens next?
And then you have a change of plane, and it's a 1.5 hours from Istanbul to Beirut. And Turkish Airlines, for me, offered the least amount of time that I had to lay over, really. So they used to be based in, I think it's Atatürk Airport. And on the 6th of April, they changed to a brand new airport. Now, this is like a city. It's even worth going just to go to the airport. It is so incredible. If you kind of think the Dubai, Abu Dhabi, but magnify that, you know, stretch out the walkways, all the beautiful shops that they have. I mean, you could spend your holiday money in the airport before
so
you go anywhere.
So if you happen to have a long layover, there's stuff to do there.
Oh, there's plenty to do. It's absolutely, it's beautiful. And I mean, Turkish Airlines themselves, they fly everywhere, and they're a real kind of hub, you know, for flying to Africa, for flying to Asia, you know, for, Istanbul is, you know, so you fly into Istanbul and on to the various, And I was actually lucky enough to be able to use the lounge, which was a real treat. And that's just like a 7-star hotel. It is just, I mean, the food in there, there's a cinema, there's sleeping pods, you know, if you're lucky enough to
and
get in early.
And here was me about to get incited about my Turkish Airlines experience in South Africa when I got an old hot face cloth and Turkish Delight. But you took it a step further on, yeah.
I took it a step further. And this was the beginning. This is the beginning of my trip. So it was certainly laying it all out for me.
A lovely
me.
Way to start. So tell us a little bit about your Easter experience then.
So, being there at Easter was a really special time. I mean, I was, you know, vaguely aware of there were different Christian traditions in Lebanon. There was Orthodox, there was Maronite, there was Catholic. But I wasn't aware of how much of a spiritual pulse there is to the country. And the first night that I was there, I arrived in the middle of the night, but the first proper night I was there, I spent the night in a monastery in the Kadisha Valley, which is up in the north of the country. And the monastery was carved out of the rocks in the year 350 AD.
Wow, it puts new meaning to in the middle of nowhere.
No, literally. It was 5 kilometres off the main road, up, like you climb up into this, up steps into the hills, into this monastery. And there was just myself, the nun who kind of ran the monastery, and there was the body of the patriarch who founded the monastery in the next room. So there was just the three of us, if you like, in this monastery. But I, you know, and I suppose ordinarily that would probably freak me out a little bit, but I felt such peace there. It was heaven. It was just like a little piece of heaven, and I could totally get why, you know, there are monastic hermits, and why people go into solitary, you know, and just
to
pray.
We're lucky we got you back at all.
Well, I mean, that's how the whole trip started. And then I just, you know, of the north of Lebanon, it's just full of monasteries dotted over the hillsides and the mountains. It's a very, very mountainous country. Small country, about 256 kilometres up north to south, and about 58 wide, but a lot of it is mountain. And so that was kind of how, that was the geography of it, and how my kind of trip started. Then as we kind of progressed into the middle of the week, I had made contact with, through YWAM, Youth with a Mission here in Ireland, I wanted to visit their corresponding organisation in Lebanon, which is called GWAM, Generation with a Message. and they work with refugees, and they have an education centre, which is basically a school, but they don't have a licence for it to be a school, so it's called an education centre. So the children of the refugees that have come from mainly Syria, but there's 500,000 Palestinian refugees there and 1.5 million Syrian refugees in a country of the size that I've just told you, which has 4 million inhabitants. So they have basically 4 million inhabitants and 2 million refugees. It is an enormous challenge, you know, it really is. Just even for the, you know, to feed and to clothe and to house these people, but also for, you know, the stability of the country and the economics of the country and the politics. It's just, it's a bit of a minefield, but GWAM do an amazing job at caring for some of them. So I went down to spend a day with them. We visited the school, met a beautiful soul who is the school principal, Nadine, and she explained to me basically how this school, how the system works, and I've got a little clip of her there.
Okay, so I'm not... this is a clip of the school principal, is it? Because I have
Nadine, one
here from... about Mohammed, I think, is the first one that I have.
How the school works.
Okay, so I'll have to try and find that one. I'm just looking for it here. Tell us a little bit about the school, anyway.
Well, the school is... They have about 88 children in the school. They teach them reading, writing. They start them with the English. Because in Syria, they don't get taught English in schools. But in Lebanon, the schools are taught through English and French. So they're at a bit of a, you know, kind of a disadvantage when they come. So they need a little bit of that. But
here's the principal explaining a little bit more.
It's an educational centre. Basically, we have like 185 to 190 Syrian refugee kids that come from really poor conditions. And they live in tents and unfinished houses. And we have them here because in order to be integrated in public schools, it's hard for them. They don't have English in Syria, and then suddenly they have to be learning everything in English. As well, like, our schools are really overloaded now, and it's kind of tough for them. We teach a lot of things like English, math, and science, and arts, and sports. And mainly we focus on loving the kids because they come from a trauma background and they still actually experience trauma in their houses in a way. They are not kind of functional families because the parents are coming out of a war. They're traumatized and sometimes they vent on their kids and the kids come here and they sometimes are so much violent with each other. So what we actually are trying to communicate with the kids is love. And we talk about how God loved us and he wants the best for each one of us. And we have every day in the morning like a time, it's like time with God. And we pray for peace. We pray for reconciliation. We pray for them to be kind to one another, teaching by an example, because they don't have an example at their homes, a role model. So in this way, they kind of see another choice.
You know, some of the families, they have really got challenges because, you know, they have a lot of kids. And what Nadine told me was that some of the you know, often the father might have been killed in Syria and the mother has fled with the children. And, you know, if she has a couple of girls, there's a real challenge. They're trying to, like, GWAM are trying to get the girls into school, but it's a real challenge for the mother. And she was telling me about one of the kids was married off at 11. Now, which seems, how could a mother do that? But she has to, she's got no male figure, you know, no father there. So she has to, support the family. Plus, if she has a lot of, if she has a couple of girls and she's paranoid about them really, what the word would be, getting stained, you know, if a man, you know, if they have any kind of abuse going on, or if, you know, if they get raped or something, then no one will touch them ever again. And so they want to get them married off so that they're safe within, you know, they've got a husband and they're going to be looked after. So it's a real challenge for them to get them into school, to get them educated, to convince the families that this is the way to go forward.
That is the foundation that women need,
Yeah, but some of the children were absolutely gorgeous, and I had a quick chat with in broken English with Mohammed.
My name is Mohammed Sharq.
And Mohammed, how old are you? What age are you?
I'm 10 years old.
Okay. And do you like school?
Yes.
What do you learn in school?
Everything.
Do you learn about Jesus?
Yes.
What do you learn?
Because he is good for me and see my heart inside, not outside.
Oh, that's absolutely gorgeous.
Adorable.
I talked to some of the kids. Tell us about some of the places you stayed then.
Well, I based myself, because it's such a small country, I based myself most of the time, apart from the night in the monastery, in Beirut. And I stayed in a small family-run hotel in West Beirut, in Hamra. And it's called the Mayflower. And I liked the idea of it because it had so much history to it. It was founded in 1957 and kept going right through the Civil War, one of the very few hotels that did. And it was always filled with foreign correspondents, you know. So I kind of thought, oh, that's kind of appropriate, you know, for me to stay there.
You found the right place as a journalist, yep.
Absolutely, yes. And it also had a history of during when the Irish soldiers were, you know, peacekeeping with the UN in Lebanon, that on their day off or their time off, they would go and they would stay in the Mayflower. So I felt there was lots of connections, and it was a lovely, really, you had real family feeling to it. And I got to know the owners managers very well, and they actually invited me to spend Easter with them, to spend Easter Sunday. We went to church, and then went back to the mother's house and had a fabulous spread for Easter. But there was a really interesting connection to Brian Keenan.
Well, Brian was a very good friend to Munir, and he met Munir, and then he rented the house. We had houses also apart from the hotel, you know. It was 10 minutes walk from the hotel. And he rented a house with a lovely terrace and a garden. And I was there. Munir was not. He was abroad at the time. So I was there. I was looking after them if they needed anything. And one day Brian told me, you know, I don't feel very comfortable because at night I see people around, you know, the garden all around. I said, okay, no problem. I will put a fence on your terrace. But unfortunately, you know, after 2 days when he was going to his work at the American University, he was kidnapped. So I used to know him before. And it was very sad. And we tried our very best to see what was going on. And lucky enough, after 5 years, he came out of his prison. And we were so pleased. It was amazing.
That's incredible, the stories that you came across there.
Oh,
and of course, you put a smile on everyone's face because you brought home lots of delicacies from the Lebanon. I've tried the skin on almonds. Not sure they'll go on my shopping list the next time, but glad I tried them. But I'm munching into some baklava today, which is lovely.
Oh, yeah.
Golden syrupy pistachio pastry. Nothing not to like about that. It sounds like you had an incredible trip, but a really blessed trip as well.
Oh, very much so.
And you've probably given people some inspiration in terms of doing some solo travelling, but just as well, just even making friends with the owners of the hotel you're staying in. It's a great
example. The generosity and the hospitality offered to me was incredible. It was a very special place to be at Easter. I mean, I sampled so many, or frequented so many of the different churches and the celebrations over Easter. It was just, I mean, I feel like I'm a walking, I feel like I'm doing the work of the Lebanese Tourist Board, but I strongly recommend everyone to visit Lebanon. It is 100% safe. At no stage did I feel any way afraid or fearful walking around. I know, 100% safe, and it's a very enriching country.
Sounds like somewhere I'll have to put on my to-do list. Maybe sans a newborn baby, but sometime in the future on the bucket list. Oh, Anya, thanks for chatting to us about your experience in the Lebanon this morning. Current figures are now estimating that the recent Easter Sunday attacks in Sri Lanka have left over 320 people dead and 500 people injured. There are reports today that there is a chilling clip that vows that there will be more attacks in Sri Lanka. On the line to give us an update on what they know and some of the conversations they've been having with churches and communities on the ground and how they've been affected by the attacks, we have John Pontifex, Head of Press and Information at Aid to the Church in Leeds. John, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
Well, obviously Aid to the Church in Leeds does a huge amount of work in relation to Christians who are persecuted in countries throughout the world. Would Sri Lanka have been a country, John, that you would have been worried that something like this would happen in?
No, actually this came as a complete bolt from the blue. We obviously would associate extremist activities with countries such as Iraq or Syria or somewhere else in the Asian subcontinent, or a country like Pakistan or indeed the Philippines. But Sri Lanka was just not on the list. So when I first heard the news, I thought the person telling me must have got the country in question wrong. But of course, it was later confirmed on the news. So it comes as a great, great shock.
So in terms of what we know now or what the latest is, John, what are you hearing?
Well, we are deeply concerned that this particular crisis is not at an end. There are continuing threats, concerns that the attackers may still be abroad and may still yet carry out further attacks. And it's significant that a decision was made early on in the weekend that there should be no masses in the Colombo area on Sunday. They were cancelled, and we know that a good number of the people who are suspected to be responsible have been rounded up, and there was that gun battle that we heard about. But there are still reports that many suspected of involvement in this attack are still around. So the problems are still there, and we can but hope that the security forces step up to address this, because of course there have been concerns that intelligence that came from India to Sri Lanka was not widely shared, and that the focus was not on the threat from Islamist extremist movements, but from other forces at work in Sri Lanka. So there's been something approaching an admission from the authorities that they were not necessarily as focused as they could have been on this threat. So this means they're catching up with events and seeking to get a grip of what's happening, and that process is still ongoing.
In terms of Aid to the Church in Need, John, do you have much connection with churches or communities on the ground in Sri Lanka?
We do, and just a day or so after the attacks, we were in contact with Bishop Mendes from Chilor, who quickly told us his thoughts about the atrocities, describing them as a crime against humanity. And he spoke about how our Easter joy was taken away from us, and that rather than being a day of rejoicing, Easter Sunday had become a day of mourning. And he begged us, saying, "We need your prayers that peace and harmony may be restored in our country." So there's a great concern there from our bishop contacts in Sri Lanka. The situation is still not marked by peace and harmony, but by continuing threat. And we know that Cardinal Ranjith, the Archbishop of Colombo, has spoken out appealing across the various divisions within Sri Lanka to appeal for peace, and making clear that, in his view, the root of this does not lie with politics or indeed with religion, but with disaffected groups on the fringes of society.
Indeed, I saw a photo today just online where it was two gentlemen holding a banner outside their mosque saying that they wanted to let their mosque be used for mass if that's what people wanted. And I just thought it was a beautiful image, because probably in general, John, when you think of Sri Lanka in terms of interfaith relations, they would be good.
Well, that's right. And when I travelled to Sri Lanka back in 2005, shortly after the Boxing Day 2004 tsunami, we drove from village to village, and it was interesting the degree to which there was such a spread of different faith communities. You go through a Buddhist community, then pass through to village and find it's a Christian one, another village would be a Muslim one. And the sense was that in this country, you've got a mixture of different faiths, and that they're, I wouldn't say they're evenly balanced, but there is significant minority groups representing different faith communities. And it was a country that, you know, putting to one side the Tamil Sinhalese division, was marked by a high degree of interfaith activity and engagement. So it came as a terrible shock to people when they saw what had happened. The hope is that the country can quickly return to that process towards peace that's been unfolding for the last 10 years since the final end to the conflict in Sri Lanka, the civil war, finally came to an end. So it's a time of great tension, and it could go either way, it seems.
I have to say, when I think of my own experience in Sri Lanka and so many of the beautiful churches that I got to visit, including St. Anthony's, one of the churches that was attacked, yes. I should say, it just makes me very sad when I think of the beautiful experience I had there. And so sad, John, to see today, as you mentioned, people basically not able to attend Mass in parts of Sri Lanka because it's still not seen to be safe. In terms of what people listening can do to help, I know Aid to the Church in Need is trying to basically launch an appeal to help in practical ways.
Yes, what we have had from all our contacts in Sri Lanka, be they bishops, be they priests, be they lay people, is repeated calls for prayer, because at this time we sense from them a great deal of sadness, of grief, of shock, even disbelief that this could have happened. And their morale is low, and they need the support, the compassion, the prayers of all of us at this time of great sadness, and a time when there's an urgent need to reach across different communities to find a way forward and to beef up the security as appropriate, and but at the same time to enable people to carry out their lives of faith with due regard for the rule of law, and a sense all the time that they are better together, they're stronger together than would be the case if they were divided, if they were somehow separated. So these people who've carried out these attacks have sought to divide a community. Our job as a charity is to bring them together and enable the Christian faith to flourish, to grow in that context.
What was the reaction from the British Parliament, John? There was, I think it was about 3 or 4 days before our Taoiseach, our Prime Minister, made any sort of remarks in relation to it. It seems to be quite underplayed here. What's it been like in the UK?
Yes, I think there's been a sense, whilst it's been absolutely front page news, headline news, the sense that we've had is that the religious dimension, the way in which we can see that this particular attack, series of attacks, represents a real indication that the Islamist militant threat is an international pandemic. It's not isolated to one community or one country. It could happen any time, any place, at a moment's notice. And the sense is that this must be seen in an international sense, in a global sense even, and that the threat is as real in any part of the world, and that thanks to social media, thanks to excellent communications and network intelligence, the Islamists have this truly global reach, theoretically. And we all need, therefore, to work together, recognising that the problem for them is, in fact, a problem for us too.
Indeed. John, thanks so much for joining us on the programme for that update this morning. That's John Pontifex from Aid to the Church in Need. You can stay up to date with them and indeed support the appeal that they have launched to help those in Sri Lanka at acnuk.org.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.